Hello, it's Wednesday the 18th of March. I'm John Dennis. Today, a new Guardian poll shows the Tories holding on to their 12-point lead over Labour. But David Cameron hasn't won the election yet.
It feels to me like a lot of these people are people who voted Labour in the past, who've got fed up with them, who've gone to other parties, and may think about coming back.
Also today, a new study shows the risks of obesity. Even being moderately overweight can take years off your life.
For people who are moderately obese, which could be about a third of the population in Britain nowadays, they lose about 3 years of life expectancy because they're moderately obese.
And how the lessons of regenerating the coal fields can be applied to the UK in the current recession.
You know, we're going to do our best to say to MPs and others, come on, this is exactly the sort of things a Labour government should be doing at this juncture.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's the news headlines in the papers with Sandy Waugh.
Unemployment is likely to rise above 2 million in Britain today. That was the number out of work when Labour came to power 12 years ago. Analysts expect the jobless total may reach more than 3 million before the end of the recession. The World Bank said in its latest forecast that it expects the slump in Britain to last through 2010, longer than in any other major economy. A Guardian poll by ICM says Labour still has a slim chance of holding off the Tory challenge at the next election, but it depends on being able to show that the economy is beginning to improve. The Conservatives have maintained their 12-point lead over Labour, with David Cameron as the most popular choice for Prime Minister. We'll have more details shortly. The head of the city watchdog, the Financial Services Authority, will publish his proposals to overhaul regulating the city today. The chairman, Lord Turner, will call for restrictions on lending during boom years, including on home loans. He also plans to tighten pay policies, high-risk trading by banks, and force hedge funds to be more open. The FSA also wants to restrict bonuses paid for short-term financial gains. In the USA, the Treasury Secretary said he will claw back millions paid out in bonuses to the insurance company AIG. The company had to be rescued from collapse by a government bailout, but then it appeared staff would be paid more than $160 million in bonuses. The Treasury said the money would be deducted from the next loan due to be paid out by the government. In Madagascar, off the African coast, military leaders have completed the coup they began this week. They've agreed to support the opposition leader as president. The former president finally resigned after his palace was stormed by tanks. And in Colombia, South America, leftist rebels have freed their last known foreign hostage. He's a Swede in his 60s who was seized 2 years ago from the ranch where he'd retired. It's not known if the rebels from the group FARC insisted on the payment of a ransom. Most papers this morning carry pictures of the actress Natasha Richardson with her husband Liam Neeson. She's seriously ill after a skiing accident. The Telegraph tells us she fell during a skiing lesson while staying at a Canadian resort. The Times says she's fighting for her life. The Mirror speaks of Liam's vigil by her bedside. And the Mail reports she has now been flown home to die with her family. The Guardian leads its front page with a new report on education from the Good Schools Guide. It says that single-sex schools both improve GCSE results and help struggling pupils. Girls especially are more likely to thrive if taught separately from boys. The Mail and the Sun also lead with education. Broken English, says the Sun headline, because a million school kids' first language is foreign. The Mail says that English is a second language for one in seven pupils. The Telegraph puts the Mid-Staffordshire Hospital report on its front page. It says that targets were blamed for 1,200 deaths. The Independent chooses the same story, calling it the Hospital of Death. The Financial Times, surprisingly, tries to be more cheery. It says the bailed-out bank, RBS, has benefited from buoyant corporate banking since the beginning of the year. RBS sees its first signs of optimism, says the headline. More news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
A Guardian ICM poll today puts the Tories on 42% and Labour at 30%, both unchanged. The Lib Dems are up 2 to 20%. So for the third month in a row, the Conservatives have maintained a 12-point lead over Labour. And even more people regard the Tory leader David Cameron as the most popular potential Prime Minister of the three main party leaders. But The Guardian's head of politics, Will Woodward, says today's survey does offer a glimmer of hope for Gordon Brown.
Yes, on the face of it, it still looks quite bad news. The Tories are 12 points ahead. They've been 12 points ahead for the last 3 months. And Brown doesn't come out very well against David Cameron at all. but we think there's just enough in it to give him some hope. If he can improve the economy, if he can go as late as possible, which I guess is May or June of next year, if he can go as late as possible for the next general election, then maybe he's got a chance.
Would signs of a recovery in the economy actually change the way people intend to vote?
For most people, it wouldn't. Roughly two-thirds of people say it would make no change at all. But of course, they include many Labour voters. But there is a minority of people. There's roughly 1 in 5 Liberal Democrats, 1 in 10 Conservatives, who say, if the economy improves, I'll consider voting differently and I'll consider voting Labour. Now, not all of those people are necessarily going to shift, and it's one thing to say the economy is going to improve, it's another thing actually acting on it. But nonetheless, it feels to me like a lot of these people are people who voted Labour in the past, who've got fed up with them, who've gone to other parties, and may think about coming back.
How do the Tories regard their poll lead over Labour? Because it's been double digits for quite a long time now, but do they regard that as solid?
Well, there is some anxiety among the shadow cabinet, among the, if you like, the rank and file of Conservative MPs, that somehow they've not grasped the election in the way they could have. If you think about before 1997, which is the last time we had a change of government, it's pretty hard to imagine that David Cameron is feeling as bullish as Tony Blair did, say, in 1996. Tony Blair had a huge poll lead. Virtually all the arguments were going his way. Now, as I say, I don't want to overplay this because Cameron is still in a really strong position, but it's not in the bag.
One quite interesting aspect of the poll, Will, is voters' attitudes towards reducing the gap between rich and poor. Because we've heard quite a lot recently about the damage that inequality does to society. But it's not necessarily such a plus point for Labour, this, is it?
No, I mean, this is a fascinating finding, really. On the one hand, you've got a massive majority, roughly 4 to 1 in favour of action to reduce the gap between rich and poor. We didn't ask about how they would like that to be done, and there's an argument that you could ask different sorts of questions around that which would give you different answers. But nonetheless, massive majority in favour. But Labour is only just ahead. I think it's about 10 points. They're only just ahead as the party most likely to do it. Now, back in the day, we regarded Labour as being the party of equality and the Tories as being the party of tax cuts. And the poll shows that while those brand loyalties are still there to a degree, it's much more evenly split than it might have been 5-10 years ago.
Will Woodward, and there's full details of the ICM poll today at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website, keep calm and carry on. Is it the Athena poster of our day? Find out at guardian.co.uk/G2. What to eat to celebrate the Iranian New Year? The mind boggles. guardian.co.uk/food. And why the pop-idol-esque Afghan star has got Afghanistan gripped? guardian.co.uk/Afghanistan. Being overweight can shorten your life, according to a major new study. Even moderate obesity, which is now common, reduces life expectancy by about 3 years. The study was carried out by an Oxford University team, and one of the leaders of the team was Professor Sir Richard Peto.
We followed 1 million people for about 10 or 15 years to see who died of what, and then linked it back to what's called their body mass index, which is essentially how fat they are, how overweight they are. And we found that for people who are moderately obese, which could be about a third of the population in Britain nowadays, they lose about 3 years of life expectancy because they're moderately obese. And that's about a third as bad as cigarette smoking. So a cigarette smoker would lose about 10 years of life expectancy. What we found for people who are severely obese, say about double the ideal body weight, we found for them that they did lose about 10 years of life expectancy, so that's about as bad as smoking. So lifelong cigarette smoking would be about as bad as being really severely obese. If you're moderately obese, and even more if you're severely obese, you've got a higher risk of heart attack, of stroke, and also of dying from liver or kidney disease. These are the big things. There's a slightly higher risk of dying from cancer But the main thing is driving the excess mortality among the people who are obese is actually heart attack and stroke.
And how aware are people of the risks that they face, even just being moderately obese?
I think people know that obesity carries a risk, but they don't really know how that risk compares with, for example, other risks like smoking. The fact is that moderate obesity is about a third the risk of smoking, and it's not until you get to severe obesity, where your weight is about double what it ought to be, that you finish up with the risk that a smoker has. So I don't think people know the size of the risks and how to compare different risks. The biggest killers in middle age in Britain today would be, number one, smoking, and then for non-smokers, second on the list, would be obesity.
And for even people who are obese but find it difficult or impossible to lose any weight, the advice would still be, don't get more overweight.
Well, I wouldn't give advice to anybody, but I just tell them what the numbers are. Yeah, I mean, it's actually easier to avoid carrying on putting on weight sometimes than it is to lose weight. Losing a lot of weight can be difficult, but stopping putting on weight is perhaps more practicable.
Professor Sir Richard Peto. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, how the credit crunch is affecting the TV reality show The Apprentice.
Like any product, and this is a product, we can like it, BBC can like it, and even the journalists can like it, but at the end of the day, the customers are the ones that will decide.
But first, the lessons learned from regenerating Britain's former coal fields should be applied to the recession that's currently gripping the wider economy. That's what the Audit Commission says in a new report. 200,000 jobs were lost in mining areas between 1984 and 1997. That's one quarter of the total male workforce. It devastated the mining communities, but the Commission's report praises the way the coal fields were regenerated, especially after the mid-1990s, when major resources from Whitehall and the European Community were deployed. The chair of the Audit Commission, Michael O'Higgins, spoke to The Guardian's Martin Wainwright yesterday at a conference in Doncaster.
One of the problems in the coalfield areas was that much of the intervention and attempt at recreating local economies came long after the jobs had been lost, and a culture of worklessness had grown up, which has had many sort of health and related problems coming with it. And I think it's important that you don't let people get used to worklessness, but that you intervene early to try to do something about it.
And if I can just pick you up on that one, the way things are now is early. Are we at early? And I don't mean to draw you into politics, but as an auditor, is early in terms of the possible effects of the recession now, do you think, or a matter of months or this year? If people are thinking, you know, when should we be taking steps?
Right. Well, I should say I'm not an auditor. I chair the commission, but I'm not personally an auditor. But I think early does mean now, because the jobs are being lost already. And even if they're not yet lost, we know that there are going to be more job losses in the next 6 months. All the forecasts say that. Therefore, I think you can begin thinking about how would you respond to significant job loss. There's a very good example in, I believe, Sunderland, where within a day of major job loss being announced, they had a jobs advice centre at the plant where the jobs were going to be lost, putting ideas together for people to know what they needed to know, where they could go to help, so that the help was available rapidly for people.
Now, the other two lessons you've drawn from this are understanding the local community and working with it, and also working in partnership. Are those things really that everyone has taken on board? I know to begin with, especially in some coalfield areas, the local council wasn't very used to working with anyone else. But is that really past history now?
It's not past history yet, I would say. The sort of cooperation that will be necessary moving forward involves working with the wide range of local public service providers and local employers and other firms. Some areas are very good at that. Others, there are still sort of resistances and suspicions that need to be overcome. So much better than it was, say, 10 years ago, but a lesson still worth remembering for the future.
I'm with Professor Steve Fothergill, who's the director of the Alliance, which a lot of us know better as the Coalfields Community Campaign, but it's now become the Alliance because it's taken on board steel and other heavy industries. Steve, what's your reaction to the points that the Audit Commission have made? I suppose particularly the one, two of them are sort of partnership and understanding your communities, you know, don't strike me as terribly controversial, but the thing about getting in there early, and now that we're facing a downturn, are we capable of getting in early enough?
Right, firstly, let's start off and say that the Audit Commission report is a quality piece of work that, in terms of, you know, analysing what's been achieved over 20 years, I think is spot on. And I think it correctly identifies the outstanding problems of, you know, of worklessness, low skills and poor health in the former coalfields. In terms of getting in early on the recession, what happened last time round is that we had the big job losses and many people simply drifted out of the labour market altogether on incapacity benefit. That's where the big numbers of jobless individuals are these days in our areas. I suppose the great fear is that we're going to trigger that process again. So people are looking for ways of trying to keep those who lose their jobs, keeping them engaged in the labour market. And in parallel to the Audit Commission report, we've had the Houghton Review of Worklessness, which reported to government, what, just 2 weeks ago, and we're expecting a response at the time of the budget. Now, there are proposals in there which would add up to, you know, helping local authorities to keep people engaged in the labour market by, for example, funding, you know, temporary short-term jobs, which, you know, it would be a very good idea in some of the areas of high worklessness. But it doesn't seem to me that it's a foregone conclusion yet that those proposals are in the bag and going to be adopted by government, because there's a price tag goes with them. So, you know, we're going to do our best to say to MPs and others, come on, this is exactly the sort of things a Labour government should be doing at this juncture.
Professor Stephen Fothergill talking to Martin Wainwright. China's top climate change negotiator has said that countries such as Britain that buy goods made in China should take responsibility for the carbon emissions generated in their production. Jonathan Watt is our Asia environment correspondent. He's in Beijing.
He said that consumers rather than manufacturers should take the bulk of the responsibility for greenhouse gas emissions. What that means is basically good for China because less pressure on China, and it means more pressure on countries like the UK and the US that are big consumers. What he says is that something like 15 to 25% of China's greenhouse gas emissions are actually produced in the process of making exports for other countries, and so it's not fair that China should have to pay for them.
Now, this is a major obstacle to agreement at the crucial climate change meeting in Copenhagen later this year.
It is, but it's not an unforeseen one. China has often said that developing, richer nations should pay. It goes against what is the current situation. It goes against the current position of the UK government and of the European Union. But all countries are going to have to do some give and take over the course of the next 8 months. And there has recently been a growing number of economists in Europe who believe that maybe this is the right way to go and that consumers should bear more of the cost, and that might be more effective than the current arrangement, which hasn't really worked.
Why might it be more useful in terms of reducing emissions if the consumers were to shoulder more responsibility in this way?
More research needs to be done on this, but the researchers I've spoken to have said that they think essentially the big problem is that people in the West have kind of got away with consuming more and thinking that their countries are reducing carbon emissions, but actually it's just outsourcing carbon emissions, whereas it comes out more directly that they have to pay at the point of consumption, then they might reconsider their shopping habits and the habits in daily life that could actually bring down consumption.
Jonathan Watts. Well, the economy's under severe strain at the moment, so how will that affect The Apprentice? It's entertainment, but it is based on the business world. Well, the fifth series was launched yesterday in the same building that houses The Guardian's offices. Sir Alan Sugar told reporters that the recession had made it harder to be an apprentice and that the programme would reflect the credit crunch.
You'll see that at the tail end of the series, me saying that in this day and age now, you know, people are not being recruited, companies are not taking on people that can get lost in the background and just be part of some kind of unknown part of the management. Now we're looking at focusing on people that are actually going to perform and do something, whatever it is you've been taken on for. So it is much tougher much tougher out there. And I made the point to the apprentices who were going through that this is not a case of me experimenting with someone now. The person that comes on board in the end is actually going to have to do some work. Will there be a sixth series? This is very much down to the punters, really. Like any product, and this is a product, we can like it, BBC can like it, and even the journalists can like it, but at the end of the day, the customers are the ones that will decide whether it's any good or not. And I guess the BBC will make their decision based upon the viewing figures and all the usual stuff.
The Apprentice is broadcast on Wednesday, March the 25th on BBC One at 9 p.m. Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.